This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On this Election Day 2012, we'll review the role Michigan and the auto industry played in the presidential race, and we'll grab a few predictions. Plus, we'll track the long history of dirty politics and deliciously mean attack ads going straight back to our founding fathers.
They would sometimes pick up the fire tongs and physically attack each other on the floor. So fighting is part of our very political DNA.
And a conversation with legendary R&B singer, Detroit's own Betty LaVette.
It's a word they call love. Yeah, it's a word they call love.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside, but first, the news. Yes, it's here. We made it. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is Election Day. On the show, we'll take a look back at the presidential campaign waged in our state, what worked for President Obama and for Governor Romney here in Michigan. And if you thought this election was biting, we're going to take a look way back to some of the meanest presidential campaigns in American history. Plus, soul singer Betty LaVette stops by the studios to talk about her 50 years in the music business. But first, all eyes are on the election. Let's check in with some of our Michigan radio reporters who spent the day out at the polls talking to voters. We'll start with Lindsay Smith. Lindsay, you're in Grand Rapids.
Hey, Cindy. We have pretty good situations at the polls so far this morning. I haven't heard any major complaints or anything like that. I got a chance to tool around with a couple of guys who were trying to give people rides to the polls. This is Tyler Nickerson. He's with a campaign to decriminalize small amounts of marijuana in the city of Grand Rapids.
With all of the campaigns that we're working with, turnout is key. And so we're really focused on ensuring that everyone has access to the polling location.
That's Tyler Nickerson. He's got three of these just like Dodge Caravans that they've rented, that they've got tooling around the city in a couple of different spots just trying to find people to get out the vote. Now, Josh Leffingwell is another guy that's with him. They've both worked in past general elections, so I tried to poke them to see, you know, what they thought the enthusiasm level was this year to say, you know, compared to 4 years ago.
We're not seeing nearly the enthusiasm, particularly amongst younger voters.
When I look at the polling places, I've never seen them as busy as they are right now. And when I talk to people who are working at the polling places, they said that this is a bigger early morning turnout than they've ever seen. So I think that there are a ton of people voting, maybe not with the same enthusiasm, but I think that they're still getting out.
And lines here, I mean, I haven't heard of anything longer than 45 minutes is the most that I heard.
All right, and that seems to be about par. I'm hearing an hour or so, although I have to admit, I got in and out in 10 minutes this morning. I was absolutely amazed. Lindsay, thanks for checking in with us from West Michigan.
Yeah, no problem.
And now to Kate Wells, who's in our studio after checking out precincts around Washtenaw County. Kate, what, you started in Ypsilanti?
Yeah, I went over to Ypsilanti Middle School this morning. Everything was going really smoothly. It was a lot closer to the experience you had, Cynthia. People were in and out in about 15 minutes, half an hour at the most. But I one of my favorite things about Election Day is when you see the people who put stuff aside, came out no matter what. And one woman, Charity Griffiths, said that she was going to wait forever if she had to. She didn't care. She was just there to vote. And she was taking people back and forth to the polls all day.
I had to just drop my daughter off with my sister, and then I'm coming to pick her up, and she's going to go vote and get my boyfriend after work, and he's going to go vote, and anybody else who needs a ride, take them to vote. I mean, it's a priority.
She's really working hard at that. And that's really what it does take.
Yeah, you know, there was a nice patriotic feeling at the polls like there is pretty much every big general election. But you know what was interesting, Cynthia, was that what you didn't see was a lot of a real excitement. It was strange. People, maybe it's because it was kind of a cloudy, cold morning, but people were pretty subdued. I talked with one guy. He works for the Big Three and lives in Ypsilanti. His name is Red George, and he said he was pretty depressed, actually, about this election. It wasn't about the candidates necessarily for him. He says it's just been a really hard 4 years. The economy has not been easy for him.
No, it hasn't. I was jobless almost 2 years, and kind of got lucky with the job that I have now, and a lot of my friends are in the same boat that I was in before, and they've been out of work for a year, some 2-3 years, little part-time jobs here and there, but hardly paying the bills.
Kind of reflects what Lindsay heard too, kind of like people are turning out, but there's not a real buzz of enthusiasm, and it has been tough on folks, and I think he really put it perfectly. And then you went off to Ann Arbor?
And then I went over to Ann Arbor, where, again, voting seemed to be running very smoothly. People were in and out in even less time. I went to a teeny tiny place over on State Street, but there were students streaming in and out all day. One of them, Megan Raker, it was her first presidential election. She was super pumped. It was really adorable. But she says that she had to do a ton of homework, and we heard this a lot. She had to do homework just to come out and vote, and we heard this from number of people. They were prepared. They had done their research about the proposals, but that didn't mean that they felt clear on them.
I've been really nervous, actually. I wasn't nervous about the president. I knew who I was going to vote for. But, all the proposals, because that's all the ads you see here, whereas, everything after one was to amend the Constitution. And that makes me really nervous to amend, something that's an actual, thing.
She's probably, in her own college student way, saying what's on the minds of a lot of voters all over the state.
I heard this a lot. You either felt very passionate about particular ballots, or you felt in general that you'd just been bombarded with ads and you didn't know what to think.
Well, it was interesting. She seemed quite clear that she was uncomfortable with tinkering with the state constitution.
I heard that several times, too. Yeah. And I think a lot of the people who are behind particular proposals are really worried that everybody's going to go to the polls and just vote them all down. We hear speculation about that a lot.
Be worth watching. Kate, thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks, Cynthia.
And now let's head to Detroit, where reporter Sarah Swick joins us. Sarah, we heard from Kate and Lindsay that lines haven't been too long in West Michigan and Ypsilanti, Ann Arbor. You're hearing a different story, aren't you?
Yes, I am hearing and seeing both a different story, especially in the city of Detroit. I'm here at the North Rosedale Park Community House that's in northwest Detroit. And people here are waiting in line for 2 hours or more to cast their ballot. A couple folks in line that I talked to said they'd been waiting for an hour and a half and they were still standing outside, but they said that the wait was more than worth it.
It's been about an hour and a half, but everyone is so happy and it just makes it seem like it's not as long. And then, you can just jump around and stuff to keep warm. But it's worth it,
I'm just glad to be able to wait. I know so many folks, down through the years had to go through and then things that they waited. So, why can't I wait? So I'm just grateful that I'm allowed this opportunity to vote.
That was Caroline and Cortrell Barnes.
Sarah, why is it that the lines are 1 to 2 hours long? Any idea? Is there what's going on behind that?
Not entirely. I've heard around Metro Detroit, actually, in the suburbs as well, that there have been some fairly long lines, although the longest lines seem to be here in the city of Detroit. It's actually an interesting scenario here at this particular polling place because apparently they consolidated two precincts into one, and folks in one of the precincts are kind of just walking in, apparently, and voting after a very short wait, whereas folks in the other precinct are waiting in line for multiple hours. So it's unclear why that's the case. In the city of Detroit, there's also an extremely long ballot, and voters and they're voting on both Wayne County ballot proposals and city charter amendments and other city and county questions that are on the ballot here. So I think in Detroit, it's a longer ballot even than most of the folks in the rest of the state are seeing.
Sarah, are those lines deterring people? What's the overall mood?
Not here. The people I talked to in line, they, acknowledged that they're waiting, but said that they were more than happy to do it, that it's a small sacrifice to make for the privilege of being able to cast their vote.
Okay, well, thanks for that report from Detroit. Thank you so much to Sarah Swick, Michigan Radio reporter.
Thank you, Cindy.
And for news organizations all across the country, Election Day and night is all hands on deck. When you look around Michigan, hands down, the biggest newsroom in the state today will be at Michigan State University. That's where some 200 student journalists are making up Michigan's largest election coverage team, all part of an effort called My First Election, MI, like Michigan. Joining us from East Lansing is Troy Hale, the journalism faculty member who's been running My First Election, and student journalist Aaron Jordan and Alex Sharg. Troy, I want to start with you. Now, these students aren't just turning up tonight to watch the elections. This has really been a working experience for them.
Yeah. I mean, we've been working more than just today. We've been working all semester planning for election coverage and a lot of student assignments, a lot of different classes at the MSU School of Journalism have been involved in this whole election coverage for today.
Alex, take us where you're going to be tonight, and you're going to have a couple hundred people all around you.
Yeah, absolutely. How the newsroom basically is set up is a bunch of students are coming in and out all over the place, all at all times of the day. And yeah, there's a bunch of different students around. We shoot each other ideas, different stories that necessarily we wouldn't take up if we have other stories or other angles that we're going at. And it's honestly a great atmosphere because not only do you get to interact with other students, but you get the hands-on experience that most journalism students aren't probably going to get all over the country.
Aaron, this has just got to be great that here you are taking this class. You're part of this My First Election effort, and it's a presidential election year. So you really are kind of, it's really the big, big night.
It really is. This whole coverage with the election has just been all so fascinating for me, and hearing the different reasons that people are running and the different reasons, honestly, why people are voting, too. So it's really exciting for me. It's my first election right now, the first presidential election that I've ever voted in. So it's exciting for me to actually be able to vote and also report on the others that are voting right now.
Alex, what are some of the stories you're working on?
I'm working on a couple of really interesting stories. One in particular, there's actually a little bit of trouble with some of the students registering to vote. And what that means is a lot of students have registered in the past, whether 2 years ago, 3 years ago, here at Michigan State.
Uh-huh.
And some of their voter registrations has changed because of their permanent home addresses or their change in motor vehicles. And some of them are not notified that they are not allowed to vote in East Lansing because of their voter registration changes. And that all stems from basically the department, even the Secretary of State, they are required to let some of these students know that their registration has changed. And it has not happened 100% with all students in the state of Michigan.
Well, good luck tonight with the big election night. Aaron Jordan, Alex Sharg, and their faculty advisor, Troy Hale, Michigan State University. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
There may have been parts of this election that felt bitter and just plain mean. But if you think that's the case, you need to brush up on your history. We're going to take a look at some of the nastiest political fights of centuries past. That's in 15 minutes here on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As we head to our precincts today, we wanted to check in with Jack Lessenberry, Michigan Radio's political analyst, and Daniel Howes, business columnist at the Detroit News. Gentlemen, when the three of us last spoke, it was just after the final presidential debate. I asked for your campaign predictions, and you both agreed the Midwest was really the battleground for this presidential race, and that perhaps it wasn't so much it's the economy stupid, but rather it's the Midwest stupid. So, do you both agree with, yourselves? Daniel?
Yes, and I think the last week or 10 days of this campaign has, I think, proven us correct. I mean, you look at where both Obama and Romney are playing. Obama spending some last minute time in Wisconsin, Romney's in Pennsylvania. I think these are some of the key states to watch, of course, as is all-important Ohio, and even Michigan to some extent, although I think that's a bit of a heavier lift for Mitt Romney. But clearly, I mean, 2 years ago, people are forgetting, I think 2 years ago, these states all went red in the big wave in 2010. And, you know, there's been a few things that have happened, particularly in Ohio, but I wonder, I mean, I'm not surprised that there's some enthusiasm for the Republican ticket late in the game, and it will be interesting to see. I think it's going to be a trench fight all across the Midwest.
Jack?
Well, I don't think so much. I think this election is not going to be that close. I think Obama will win it by about 3 points. It'll be historically close compared to some of the blowouts we've had. But I'm more watching the South. I think Ohio is crucial. I don't think Wisconsin is really in play. It's voted Democratic in every election since 1984. I mean, if Dukakis won it, it would seem to me that likely that Obama will win it. But I'll be looking at Virginia and Florida early on. Romney needs to win both of those. If he loses either one, he's probably all done. But who knows? We could all be terribly surprised.
Let's talk specifically about Michigan. The fact that we discussed this the last time, that neither candidate had made an appearance. We saw Governor Romney here in early August, and then that's been it. There have been surrogates sent in. Disappointed but not surprised?
No. I mean, it's all about where these candidates go, where they think they need to be. And if they don't think that they can contest Michigan in a meaningful way, the Republican candidate is not going to come here. And I suspect that it is going to be a heavy lift. I mean, there could be a surprise, but because there's certainly been a lot of discussions about the polling and things like that. But, you know, the overall trend of the polling would suggest that Obama probably wins Michigan.
I agree with that. And I think that Romney's looked at George W. Bush, spent a lot of money and time in both of his elections trying to win Michigan, came up short both times.
Talk about the auto industry now. It seems it certainly played a huge role in this race, especially in the closing weeks. And The three of us have talked about this before. So here's the question. What happens to the issue of the auto industry now in the minds of the American public after the election day is done? Does it kind of curl up and go away, or is it still top of mind but perhaps with a less political tone?
Well, my view, and I actually wrote a column about this morning, my view on this is that this goes, once this election is over, the whole bailout debate that's been raging for 4 years goes from becoming a hot political question to becoming a historical debate. If Barack Obama wins re-election, I think there's every expectation that his Treasury Department will move ahead with unwinding the remaining shares that they hold in General Motors, probably in small pieces, so it's not a real seismic financial event. And Romney, I think, has made it clear that if he is president, he would sell those shares and take the loss and move on. People can argue about it, but as a political matter, Barack Obama could not be hurt by it again because he can't run for re-election. And I think Romney would take some action pretty quickly and say, hey, it wasn't my decision, and I'm getting out of it.
I couldn't agree more. I think Daniel's exactly right. I think that if Obama wins Ohio, it will be because of the auto bailout. Ohio is historically more Republican in close elections. So that may be the story of tonight. But after this election, whoever wins, the auto bailout is history, and the automakers are going to have to, it's going to be a whole new dynamic, and people will be looking at them in a different way.
What kind of dynamic? Talk about that new dynamic that the automakers will be working under.
Well, I think there's been some sympathy, and this whole campaign has been about is the Obama people have framed it with some success, that we saved the auto companies and everybody's happy because we saved the auto companies. But, you know, that was then and this was now, and the auto companies are going to be scrutinized to see if are they continuing to make profits, are they paying the government back, and if they get in trouble again, I'm not sure there's going to be any sympathy for another bailout. And also, they are never, and I think Daniel will agree with me, they're never going to be the mass employer of unskilled labor at high wages that they were. And I think to some extent, the auto companies as a political factor in this country are going to dwindle.
I would say they would continue to be a factor in the Midwest to some extent, but you're absolutely right. I think we know what the trends are from an employment base. I think the other thing that I think needs to be said about the auto bailouts and the auto companies in this cycle is they are probably have emerged as the most distorted and selectively rendered topic in the entire campaign. I mean, you would think, listening to the Democrats and the president, that you know, Romney wanted to take Detroit bankrupt, and the administration didn't. Well, but they did. When you start to disaggregate some of the stuff, you realize that there is very little daylight between not only Mitt Romney, but a lot of other plans, and also what the Bush administration started to do, the road they started to go down in December of 2008. And Romney, on his side, has said some really stupid things, like he said, personally said, that they wanted to ship all production of all Jeeps to China from the United States, which is patently untrue. it's just been a continual litany of distortions, and not just by the candidates, but by the campaigns, by their surrogates. It drives those of us that know this industry pretty well around the bend to listen to some of this stuff.
And I suspect in the offices of the automakers, it's driving them around the bend, too, because the last thing, we've talked about this, they wanted to be is the poster child for what was broken and I fixed it.
Oh, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, and I know General Motors, it's driving them crazy, but they're in a position where they can't really be out front and say much about this. Chrysler, to their credit, I suppose, came out and issued some statements about this whole Jeeps in China thing, including a letter from the CEO, Sergio Marchionne, that was made public, saying, you know, what their exact plans were. But again, some of this stuff and some of their long-term plans have been known to those of us that cover the industry for some period of time, but in a campaign like this, it all gets treated like it's new news when it really, in fact, isn't.
To me, the big mystery of this campaign is that Romney just couldn't leave this issue alone. He ought to have said in the Michigan primary, that was then and this was now, and everybody is happy that the auto companies are thriving, but he kept returning to it in sort of a John Kerry-like, I voted for it before I voted against it, and everything he said, see, true or not, seemed to make it worse for him.
Well, I think that's true, but I think part of that, Jack, was that he was also bludgeoned. You know, that the New York Times headline on that op-ed from November 2008 was an absolute gift to the Obama campaign. And no matter what he said, they could continue to beat him over the head with that. And that's really how modern campaigning can work. You know, I've had my own discussions with political types who, you know, you start to talk to them about the nuances of the issue that they're demagoguing, and they'll just come back to the point and say, all I know is X. And all I know is that Romney had wrote an op-ed that was headlined, Let Detroit Go Bankrupt, and they continue to use that, and it resonates with people. If they're too lazy or dishonest to actually look at some of the issues and try to understand what actually happened.
Well, on the other hand, though,
people don't.
On the other hand, Romney talked as if, and sometimes he still talks as if, this could have been done with private money, with money in the capital markets, and that money just wasn't there in 2009.
You're right. And we got, when the Detroit News Editorial Board interviewed Romney in February of 2012, I pushed him personally on that issue. And he said they could have guaranteed the loans. And I said, look, you're in this business better than I do. There wasn't the money there. And he looked at us and he said, I, as president of the United States, would not allow these companies to fail. That they would have used, had he been president, he would have used Treasury money if he could have to keep them afloat. Now, he said that in one interview with one group of journalists. That wasn't a talking point that they used regularly, and I think that kind of makes your point.
You're right, though, Daniel. I don't think any president could have let them fail politically. George W. Bush started the bailout. I think anybody would have done it.
Well, and that's the big lie about this thing in this whole debate is, and I have maintained this for years, that any president, particularly a first-term president, who is faced with economic disaster in the industrial Midwest, which, as we're discussing earlier, is critical to re-election of a president, when faced with the situation that Barack Obama was faced with, would have done the same thing. And George W. Bush said as much. He says it in his book. He said it in a speech not too long ago, that if he had to do it all over again, he'd do it all over again. I just think it's a canard to suggest that a president, and I'm not talking about Republican senators from the South who were rooting for Detroit to fail. I'm talking about a president of either party, I don't think, would let that happen.
Can I ask both of you, we'd like to see what your predictions are. What do you think the headlines will read when we wake up tomorrow morning?
Well, I hope they don't say deadlock. I don't think we can take another one of those. Mm-hmm. But I think they'll say Obama wins, Democrats hold Senate.
I think the headlines will probably say Ohio is still too close to call, and it's not quite over, and that the ballot proposals in the state of Michigan have all failed, and the emergency manager law has been upheld.
All right, we're going to measure that, and we always enjoy talking with both of you. Thanks for talking with us this Election Day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jack Lessenberry is Michigan Radio's political analyst, and Daniel Howes is a business columnist at the Detroit News. Let's go back now into our American history books on this Election Day. You think political attack ads today are mean-spirited? Well, if you were watching TV in, well, let's say 1800, here's a sample of what you might have heard.
John Adams is a blind, bald, crippled, toothless man who wants to start a war with France. While he's not busy importing mistresses from Europe, he's trying to marry one of his sons to a daughter of King George. If Thomas Jefferson wins, murder, robbery, rape, adultery, and incest will be openly taught and practiced.
Let's go back in time and relive some of the meanest political campaigns and slogans and ads in American history as we say hello to Gleaves Whitney, who directs the Hauenstein Center for Presidential Studies at Grand Valley State University. He's also authored or edited 15 books looking at our presidents and the governors of Michigan. Gleaves, it seems very clear from that those clips we played, based on actual writings and speeches, attack ads have clearly been a part of our history right from the first presidential race.
Well, that's right, Cindy, and thanks for having me on your program. And it's so true, and I'm always amused when people say, oh, you know, our civil society is breaking down and just sort of common courtesies in these campaigns are breaking down. It's true. We have a lot of misleading and even, I think, mendacious statements in our ads. There's no question that we have a political culture which has put up with lying. But in terms of the actual comportment of the candidates, they don't fight the way they used to. I mean, remember, in the early days of the Republic, Cindy, down on the floor of the House of Representatives, when people would start to promote one candidate over the other, they would sometimes pick up the fire tongs and physically attack each other on the floor. So fighting is part of our very political DNA. You were very right, I think, to start with that clip from the election of 1800. Vicious election. I'm glad you had the clip about Adams importing mistresses and technically from France and Germany, because that became sort of this campaign strategy to actually look at the very moral Adams as a debauched man.
Well, did Thomas Jefferson really call John Adams a hermaphrodite?
Well, what he did is he had Callender, who was his paid publicist, do it in the Richmond Examiner. Callender did all the dirty work. But, you know, Jefferson was mean-spirited on a number of occasions, and it's hard for us to summon this side of Jefferson, the author of the Declaration of Independence, for Pete's sake. I mean, what's going on here?
Right.
But he so angered George Washington in the way he treated both Washington and Adams that George and Martha never spoke to him again.
Wow.
I mean, these are our founding fathers who were at loggerheads and then almost came to fisticuffs again and again. So it's very early on in this election of 1800. They were hurling horrible, scurrilous things at each other. And the funny part of it is Jefferson needed Pennsylvania's electoral votes.
Okay.
And so they not only cooked up the rumor that Adams had had mistresses shipped in from Germany and France, they further refined the rumor by saying, well, Adams sent the German mistresses back to Germany in order to offend the electors of Pennsylvania so they would vote for Jefferson.
Gotcha.
Because you got the Pennsylvania Dutch there, the Germans.
Yes. So total dirty tricks.
Total dirty tricks. Layer upon layer of dirty tricks.
Now, the Stephen Douglas Abraham Lincoln contest got kind of nasty. I found that one quote, Mr. Douglas labeling Mr. Lincoln as a hatchet-faced nutmeg dealer. Well, first of all, what did they have against nutmeg dealers?
I know. And, you know, the famous quotation of all time coming out of Lincoln and Douglas is that, you know, Douglas accused Lincoln of having two faces, and Lincoln knew he was ugly, and he said, my dear friend, Mr. Douglas, if I really had two faces, would I have come out with this one?
Oh. Now, I remember from my history studies the famous slam in 1884 against Democrat Grover Cleveland, who'd been accused of siring an out-of-wedlock child. And that slogan was?
Gone to the White House. Ha, ha, ha.
Mama, where's my pa?
All right.
Who got the last laugh with that one?
I know. Well, that was another one. It shows that sex scandals always sell in national politics. Bill Clinton certainly learned it. John F. Kennedy was spared it. There was a point, in fact, in the 1960 campaign where Richard Nixon was urged to talk about John F. Kennedy's indiscretions, and Nixon said, no, I will not do it. He was a fine colleague of mine, and I will not take the race to that low level.
Really?
There have been, and this from Nixon, you know, who we usually don't think of as you know, a civil politician, but somebody who practices character assassination. I mean, you remember the senator he ran against, Nancy Hagan Douglas, he said she was pink down to her undies, you know. I mean, there have been some scurrilous things said, you know, in these candidates, but also opportunities for nobility and restraint, and we also need to celebrate that as well.
Indeed.
When we can.
You know, I just wonder, talk about attack ads and campaigns. Is it a safe bet to say, Gleaves, that voters hate negativity except when they like it?
I like it. I think all of them are like my Aunt Bitsy, who says, if you have something bad to say about somebody, come sit by me.
Yeah.
I mean, and of course, that's traced back to Alice Roosevelt Longworth. You know, I think Americans are a little bit two-faced in this. Yes, we say we want civility, but boy, we love the good fight, don't we? We actually are entertained by it to some extent, and it makes the cocktail rounds more interesting.
It does indeed.
I remember even, say, in our lifetimes, we, you know, for most of us today, you know, if we go even back to, say, the 1980 election with Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter, we see, you know, that Reagan was very viciously mocked by the media. And, in fact, it was common in some broadcasts to call him Ray Gun, R-A-Y hyphen G-U-N.
I remember that.
Yes, with the insinuation that this guy was reckless, mm-hmm. he had a quick nuclear trigger finger, and that we would all be in the Armageddon if he were elected. And so, you know, there have been some pretty low blows there, but of course, then you go to the Willie Horton ads in 1988, you know, against Dukakis when Bush was running, and you take the lowest common denominator, the worst mistake that a politician has made, and then you drill down into that. You keep airing those commercials until they become a mantra. So, you know, both sides, both political parties are equally susceptible to this kind of thing. It makes for quite a sport.
You can watch that satire video of the 1800 campaign on our website. You can go to the stateside link at michiganradio.org. We think you will get an Election Day chuckle out of it. Gleaves, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you, Cindy.
Gleaves Whitney is a scholar, author, and the director of the Hauenstein Center for Presidential Studies at Grand Valley State University. Coming up next, a conversation with singer Betty LaVette. That's here on Stateside. It's Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A quick update for you now. Authorities have arrested a 43-year-old Wixom man who they believe is connected to a series of shootings on and around I-96. Police say the arrest happened last night at the suspect's home, and it was the result of information received over the past few days. Potential evidence was collected at the home and is now being tested by police crime labs. The suspect's vehicle is known to match the description given by one of the shooting victims. What does it take to be a survivor? To believe in yourself when it seems no one else will? To keep plugging away in the face of broken promises, disappointments, you name it, and to do all of that for 50 years? Well, the answer to that can be found in the life of our next guest. It has been 50 years since she recorded her very first single at age 16. And as you'll see in her new autobiography, A Woman Like Me, it has been a very tumultuous life and career for Muskegon-born, Detroit-raised Betty Jo Haskins, who became Betty LaVette. She's just released her new album, Thankful and Thoughtful, and she is performing tomorrow night at the Arc in Ann Arbor, and she joins us here in the studio. Betty, it is a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you, Cindy. How are you?
Doing great. And I'm going to put it out right now.
Okay.
Any autobiography that starts on page one with the star of the book being dangled by her right foot from a 28th floor window of a Manhattan high-rise and that foot being held by, and I'm going to quote here, a vicious pimp, that is a sign that this is not a girl who believes in living a neat, tidy life.
Well, Cindy, I don't think that I added that to my life to keep it from being neat and tidy.
No, you have had a roller coaster ride. You have to tell this because we don't want to give away a lot about the book because we want people to get out and buy it. But how were you being dangled from 28 floors by your right foot?
it was a man who was bigger than me. And it isn't, you know, I think that when people visualize it, it's like this. But actually, you know, I was being hung over it, and my legs were being bruised against the you know, against the top of the building.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like if you were getting ready to jump and someone grabbed you.
Mm-mm.
It was more like that. He couldn't dangle me because, you know, so it was really just holding me there by one foot dangling out in the air and the other one rubbing against this cement.
Yeah, looking death in the eye, but here you are. And you start with that, but then you do take us back to your early days. And I love as you talk about your young, young days. When did you first realize that singing was in your soul?
Oh, it was a very, very long time. It was just something that I could do for a very long time. It wasn't, I'd never seen anyone on stage before the night that I went on stage. My family was not a musical family, so it wasn't a thing where I had this burning passion from childhood. I could always sing, and people always liked it. And as a kid, I mean, of course, I liked them liking me. But it never occurred to me that I could be a singer. I had never seen a singer. You know, the songs I heard earlier were on jukeboxes. I had never seen a singer that I knew of. And when the gospel singers were coming to my house, they were just people who came and drank and sang. I didn't know them as singers. I just knew them as grown people who sung songs when they came to my house.
Tell us why they were coming to your house, you had such an interesting upbringing with
your parents. Well, my family sold corn liquor in western Michigan and Muskegon during segregation. Of course, if you wanted to have a drink, if you were black after work, you couldn't drop by the neighborhood bar. Mm-hmm. You know, and there were in Muskegon no black neighborhood bars other than my house. So you came there, and my mother, if you were a single guy, my mother had barbecue sandwiches and fried chicken sandwiches, and just dancing and listening to the jukebox and drinking and lying. There was no gambling, or there were no single women there, or if there were single men there, there were no single women there for them, you know, it was just other guys. You know, and you certainly, some people brought their wives because they all worked in factories together in Muskegon, and that was the neighborhood bar.
And then you moved to Detroit when you were how old?
I was just about to turn 4.
All right.
And then in Pontiac.
And then
we went, my whole family worked at one part of General Motors or another. When we lived in Muskegon, my parents worked for parts manufacturers, and we moved to Pontiac. They worked for General Motors, and then we moved to Detroit. They continued to work for General Motors.
And at that time, the music scene in Detroit for a girl that just felt song inside of her was what? What was it like?
Oh, it was really, really easy. Everyone who wasn't producing, well, no one was called a producer then. They were called this guy who makes records. Mm-hmm. But no one was referred to as a producer. But everybody was doing this, or they were writing, or they were forming a group. Mm-hmm. And a lot of girls' groups were forming then, which there hadn't been any since the Andrew Sisters or that kind of thing. So with the Shirelles, with young black girls especially, looking into it and starting groups. And then there were a lot of young white girl groups as well. Everybody was singing. It was no big deal to record. Maybe it was a big deal because I was only 16 and because maybe nobody else in my 10th grade class had a record, but just to be in Detroit and record at that time was not a big deal.
Well, you recorded that first single for Atlantic when you were 16. Take a listen to a bit of My Man, He's a Lovin' Man. That sweet little voice. Now, what I got to ask you, to hear yourself on the radio at that age, so you're in 10th grade, you're going to and from school. What was that like to hear yourself singing on the radio?
Oh, honey, it was the same way a high school student would feel if they were drafted into the NFL.
Yeah.
You know, it was just, I was tantamount to a groupie being in show business. I mean, I was just dancing to these people's music just 1 month before. And now I was like, consider them my coworkers.
You were one of them.
Well, I certainly didn't look at it that way.
Yeah, yeah. But, and I would had to imagine recording Atlantic, big label. They have a lot of big stars. I'm mm-hmm. on my way. And then
absolutely
not And right. when you write in your book, in A Woman Like Me, you have a phrase called buzzard luck. And that buzzard luck was?
Well, at that time, my first manager being shot by Mary Wells' husband and never recovering, you know. So, and he was the only, I only knew like maybe six people in the business. And so if something happened to two of them, one shot one, the other was shot, that put me down to four. So...
Really, through the years, and when I say roller coaster ride, when you read Betty's autobiography, it truly was. It's an amazing story of so many big promises where some producer says, "You're amazing. This is going to hit. Record for me." You do. You get your hopes up, and then boom, big flop. And my
but
question.
One of the things for the book, though, for writing the book, is that nothing that ever happened was like what happened to anyone else. You know,
yeah.
So, I mean, whose manager gets shot by another singer's husband?
Yeah. So you were dogged by buzzard luck. I felt so heartbroken for you as an ambitious young singer. You finally get a chance to record an album. It had been so many singles. You were so excited. And then you open up the box and you look at the album and your picture is not even on the album cover.
Right.
All right. So how did you keep the faith and keep believing in yourself and not just say, forget it, I'm done, over those decades?
I really, over the decades, just sticking with it became easier, because if I quit after doing this for 30 years, that would mean that I would be 60 or so anyway by the time I became as proficient at anything else as I was at singing. And what Jim Lewis had always told me, my manager that I talk about so much in
yes.
the book, he said, you may never be a star, but if you will learn to sing and learn a whole gang of songs, all kinds of songs, you can work until you die. He said it's like any other job. And looking at it that way made me look at it the way people get up and go to work every day. I really had to look at it as my job. And that was more important than anything else. It was my job. Even if it only paid $50 a night or whatever, it was pretty much tax-free. It was so funny. My band laughed at me because I was so excited about paying taxes, because I never made enough money to pay any taxes. So I was thrilled.
To pay taxes.
I was.
Well, Betty, your career got a tremendous jumpstart in 2008. You were invited to sing at the Kennedy Center Honors. The Who's Pete Townsend and Roger Daltrey were among those being honored. And you took the stage and you served up an astonishing version of Love, Rain, or Me. Betty, I watched the CBS broadcast of that because I'm a huge Who fan, and I saw Pete Townsend cry. I saw him, he was tearing. You said Roger Daltrey got down on his knees to you afterward. And what was so striking was this tiny little lady
he
gets
didn't
out
get
on stage.
Down on his knees to me. He knelt down.
He knelt down.
And
there you go. That's even better. All right. My question is, and I wondered this as I watched this, so I get to ask you, where do you go when you are doing that? When I mean, it's so raw. Where are you going inside yourself?
Well, the only place I can go, to me. I mean, I couldn't go to Roger Daltrey or to anyone else. When people say, how do you make these songs your own? I said, it would be so much more difficult to sound like Roger Daltrey than it is to sound like me. So I can't make them anybody's but my own. And when I hear them, the way I sing them, that's the way I hear them. So I don't understand what the great perplexion is that I don't sound like Roger Daltrey.
Well, not so much that, but I wondered how you get yourself in a place where you can just put everything away, who's out there, what's going on, and you are just able to find something at every time you sing, not just this song, but all of them. And it just made me wonder how you're able to tap into that. So
well, that's probably the adolescence in me. It's I can't think about anything else when I'm doing one thing. So, but no, when I'm doing the songs, the words are very important to me. And if there are words that are saying a particular thing, I can't act one way and say another. I'm just not that good. So if the song is something that made me cry yesterday, more than likely it'll make me cry today.
And you just record songs you love anyway, right?
Just record songs. I'm catching so much flack right now about being a cover artist. I think if you're a singer, hell, sing the songs. Just sing the songs that are written. You know, I'm not trying to discover a new universe or whatever. I want you to hear me sing this song that we all love. Hear the way I sing it. You know, hear the way Ray Charles sing it. Hear the way Smokey Robinson sings it. I think we all should sing each other's songs. They're songs.
There you go.
They're just songs.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Betty LaVette, whose new book, A Woman Like Me, her autobiography is out, as is her new CD, Thankful and Thoughtful. And I got to think, the first time you said you were on stage, you'd never even seen a live singer. What do you get from your audiences when you're standing there and performing? And I get the feeling for an artist like you, it could be 5,000 people, it could be five people.
It's being more close to 5,000. So yeah. I'm getting a chance to deal with that a little more than I ever dealt with it before. Yeah. But I knew what I wanted in an audience. My whole approach to show business and to singing now is completely different than it has always been or than it was when I was younger. First of all, I don't care what the audience thinks at this point, and that was my only concern at one point. I pretty much sing for myself. I try to sing it. I want it to be good for me. I want it to be as good as I can possibly do it. And if it's a song that I like, then certainly it is like eating ice cream or something. You know, I like it, so I want it to be good and work out well. But now my audience is pleasing me so much because, for one thing, it is an audience. It isn't an audience that came for a wedding, and I happen to be there. It's not an audience that there are five people there who like me, and they're listening attentively, and the other people are talking all over them. The audience is the Ray Charles audience I've always looked for. They're blacks, whites, young, old, and that's really all I've ever wanted, was just a large audience that existed all over the world.
And the latest CD is Thankful and Thoughtful. Let's check out a bit of the Kim McLean song, The More I Search, The More I Die.
For the sake of both our souls, the more I search, the more I die. I wanna feel, I wanna be alive. Am I saved from, or am I broken? Am I healed, or do you think I'm just justified?
You say, Betty, that's your favorite?
Yes, oh. It definitely is. If I could write, this is what I would have written. This is definitely what I would have written.
Your band's great, and that touch of banjo in there. And you're saying you don't know what they put in the water in Nashville, but
really, it hurts the women so bad. It makes them write these songs, and they're just perfect songs.
Betty, what do you think about the American Idols, The Voice, The X Factor, all of that today, holding out the promise of maybe jumping the line and kind of cutting in ahead? Would you try that if you were a young artist?
I think it should be done just the way it used to be done with, well, here locally in Detroit, we had a program called Anti-D. And nationally, they had Major Bowls. And I think it should be that. I think that they should be considered newcomers. I think they should be considered children if they're 17 and 18 years old. And I think that at most they should win the opportunity to maybe make a record, go on the road with someone and learn to defend themselves, because Lord knows they better not run up against me. My greatest dream is to have one of them with these voices of clarity, power, and purity run up against me in a baby grand piano and sing softly. It took me years to become the singer that I am. And it's just so insulting that you could become that in 13 weeks, or that we could have a genius a year. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, what is a genius if we can have them that quickly?
Well, certainly by going through your book, A Woman Like Me, you will learn. You got to weather a lot of hard knocks. And also a good lesson that success comes when it's going to come. It may not
there
come at
go.
The beginning. You just hang in there.
Betty My Levesque. Mother says you know what's done happen, but you don't know what's going to happen. She has never been more right. There's no way you could have told me that at 100 years old I would have a career dumped in my lap.
And the book is A Woman Like Me, and it is out from Blue Rider Press. And latest album is Thankful and Thoughtful. And Betty Levesque, thank you for joining us on Stateside.
Thank you so much, Cindy, for talking with me.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside is engineered by Mark Brush. Contributors are Allie Billings, Ellen Cortezoa, Emily Fox, Cameron Stewart, and Mercedes Mejia. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening. Tomorrow we will talk at 3 and we'll have all the election results you need to know. Have a good day.